Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, we'll hear from Shannon Monat, a sociologist who did a study showing that counties that voted heavily for Donald Trump are plagued by disease and early death. And then the journalist Mark Ames will take apart the spreading Putin did it mania. Between the two, I'll offer some of my own thoughts on Russophobia. First, Trump, or specifically the health indicators in regions where Trump did particularly well. During the campaign, there were several analysts who pointed out that Trump looked to be particularly popular in rural, mostly white regions with high rates of disease and declining life expectancy. Now, the sociologist Shannon Monat, who teaches at Penn State, is out with a study examining the counties where Trump did unusually well. Her work confirms the earlier research. The more desperate the situation, the more likely the county was to vote for Trump. Shannon Monat.
You find a very curious set of circumstances that help explain the success of Donald Trump. Drug addiction and other diseases of despair seem to, counties where that those diseases are prominent, tended to vote disproportionately for Donald Trump. Give us the details.
Yeah, so nationally and in these three specific regions that I examined, which were the Rust Belt, Appalachia, and New England, Trump outperformed Romney the most in counties with the highest drug, alcohol, and suicide mortality rates, these sorts of deaths of despair.
You're looking at a larger project of what determines why these diseases of despair are so prominent. How does that fit in?
Yeah, so that was an original project that I was working on, and this election project was sort of on the side. And what I've been doing is trying to understand the common characteristics of counties with high rates of mortality from these deaths of despair. And they tend to be counties that have experienced some economic distress and economic decline, particularly over the past 30 years, especially rural counties and small cities as opposed to larger cities. These are places that have experienced some declines in the manufacturing industry or the mining industry, places where median household income has either remained relatively stagnant or has declined over the past 30 years.
Trump addressed some of these issues during the campaign, didn't he?
Yeah, so I think his message about bringing the jobs back really sort of resonated with some of these folks. So many of the counties where he did the best, economic distress has really been building, and social and family networks have been breaking down for several decades. And so what I think my findings are reflecting are just larger economic and social problems that go beyond the drugs and the alcohol and the suicide. This is really about downward mobility and the dismantling of the American dream kind of at the community level. So you should understand that in these places there are now far fewer of the manual labor jobs that once provided livable wages, once provided benefits, especially for people without a college degree. And it's not that this is new. It's not new at all. It's actually been building for at least the last three decades. And so in these places, there's this sense that America really hasn't been great for quite some time. And, you know, Trump sort of capitalized on and exploited those feelings.
Now, why do you think the economic distress of these counties takes the form of these diseases of despair? Is there some mechanism that leads to people to, you know, drinking and drugs that could explain why this happens?
Yeah, it could be that at the core of these diseases and these deaths of despair is a desire to escape maybe pain, certainly stress, anxiety, shame, and hopelessness. And so in these places that I'm talking about, jobs and the dignity of work have really been replaced by suffering and hopelessness and the feeling that America isn't so great, the belief that people in power don't really care about them or care about their communities. And a lot of these families are just one paycheck away from economic ruin, and they see a not-so-bright future for their kids. So Trump's anti-free trade message likely resonated with these folks who saw manufacturing plants shut down. They saw what were once really good paying jobs with benefits replaced by minimum wage jobs. And these are much different jobs that were available to their parents and grandparents. And so this sort of distress and shame that goes along with either losing your job and not being able to find a new one, or having a job that just doesn't allow for ends to meet, it disrupts communities. It disrupts social relationships. It also places strains on families and friendships. And so I think seeing this kind of economic change and then seeing the people around you maybe lose their jobs or spiral into addiction or depression kind of increases stress among everybody who lives in these communities, and it changes folks' interactions with their communities. It leads to declines in community cohesion, maybe attachment to community, and certainly to declines in trust.
Could you talk more about the decline in trust?
Yeah, so let's think about if you know that your neighbors are maybe having some drug problems, and maybe you're fearful of what's going on in your neighborhood. Maybe you're worried about crime and theft. Similarly, you might have family members who are addicted to opiates, and maybe they've had a really difficult time. Perhaps they've been stealing, and so it leads to distrust in the family. Alcoholism and drug abuse is also associated with abuse within the household, so it's possible that families are breaking down and being strained due to family abuse as well. And all of these things work together to lead to the feeling that things are just not quite right, and that there's sort of a downward spiral in the community.
How do you think people who live in these places received Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables comment?
So I don't know so much whether that necessarily resonated a lot with a large proportion of the population. I think what didn't work, the message that didn't work for Secretary Clinton was this idea that America was good and so it was already great. When you're seeing folks overdose, you're seeing the police in the community, you're hearing about overdoses every day on the news, you're finding out that there might be jobs available, but a large percentage of your population can't pass a drug test, then that message that America is already great isn't really resonating with you.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Shannon Monat.
And a lot of pundits, elite pundits in particular, have blamed Trump voters for being violent racists and xenophobes and Nazis. What do you think of those kinds of characterizations?
Well, I think, to be sure, racism played a role in this election, probably more so than in any election, at least in my memory. But explaining the support for Trump as a purely racist phenomenon really ignores the economic, social, and demographic complexities that drive human behavior. And it ignores the context of these communities where these voters live and what the candidates were offering them, or at least their perception of what was being offered. And so, of course, some percentage of voters are racist and xenophobic and sexist. But by and large, I would suggest that there are also economic and social realities that we need to grapple with and understand about the people and these places that led to the outcome that we saw. And that racism alone, while important, can't explain entirely the outcome of this election.
The attitudes of metropolitan elites towards people in these sorts of counties probably don't endear them to the residents who are going through this kind of suffering.
Yeah, you know, I think there's really this sense that the coastal elites, academics, the media, politicians don't really understand what it's like to live in these areas. And that the policies that are promoted and pushed perhaps by elites are not necessarily beneficial to the folks in these areas. You take, for instance, the seemingly constant message that everybody should attend college. Well, you know, certainly everybody should have the opportunity to have an affordable college experience if that's what they want. But it's just as essential that there are decent paying jobs for those without a college degree, and that those jobs are viewed as being important. So the way that I see it is that work is a source of status, financial status, social status, moral status. But the working class sort of regularly receives this message that their work is not important and that they're irrelevant and replaceable. And that message is consistently delivered to them through low wages and declining benefits, government programs for which they don't qualify but for which they have to pay taxes, and this seemingly nonstop message that everyone should go to college. So when did we start saying that everyone should go to college? Well, it was when pay for jobs for those without a college degree started to decline. So I think it's really important to understand that the way that the media and academics and politicians talk about these jobs should reflect the importance of those jobs to our economy and to our overall societal well-being. And oftentimes they're just kind of maligned or viewed as unnecessary or unimportant.
We've had some competing interpretations of the Trump vote. We have people arguing that most Trump voters had above median incomes. They're pretty well off. And then we have analyses like yours that say that the geographical roots of the Trump vote were in places that were quite deprived and quite suffering. How do we reconcile these two?
Yeah, so I think that there are a few things going on. One is that different things were happening in different places. And to be sure, there are certainly affluent voters who voted for Trump and are not experiencing economic despair and decline at all. But the other thing is that just because a family is not in poverty and just because a community's poverty rate isn't high doesn't mean that they're not experiencing economic decline. And so there is a sense in a lot of these places that perhaps they're one or two paychecks away from catastrophe. So they might not be in poverty yet. Perhaps they can pay their bills right now, but their wages haven't gone up in 30 years. And the cost of health insurance is going up. And there seem to be new programs for those who are poor. The Democrats, by the way, have done a really great job trying to get through things like Medicaid expansion and the Children's Health Insurance Program. And the Earned Income Tax Credit. These are all programs that have done quite a bit for the poor, but almost none of those programs really benefit the working and the middle classes, these folks that are kind of being squeezed in the middle. And so when they see those programs, what they see is that their hard-earned money that isn't increasing at all is going to buy food and heat and health insurance and housing for people who aren't working for whatever reason that might be. And so just because they themselves aren't in poverty doesn't mean that they aren't experiencing an economic squeeze. And I'd also say that we can't ignore the role of inequality here. The productivity of American workers has been increasing consistently since the 1940s, but wages haven't. So where are all the profits from that increased productivity going? Because they're not going to workers. So it seems to me that any time the U.S.'s pie gets larger, the very richest consume a bigger piece of it, leaving only a tiny sliver behind for everyone else to fight over. And that now includes the middle class, who are fighting over this smaller piece of economic prosperity. And then meanwhile, racial identity politics that we see manifest themselves when the economy is not quite strong, they distract everyone's attention away from the fact that only the very rich have experienced any real income growth in the U.S. since 1980. You know, income for the top 1% has more than doubled since 1980, but it's barely budged for everyone else. And so it's not just those who are poor, it's those who are feeling squeezed in the middle as well, who it seems that Trump's message resonated with.
And then finally, what you're studying, the phenomena you're looking at, I'm guessing this has a lot to do with the kinds of declines in life expectancy that we've seen among the rural white poor. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think it's likely all related, that the types of diseases that folks are increasingly dying from, heart disease and diabetes and these deaths of despair, are kind of all wrapped up in declining health in general. And a lot of that has to do with things like rising obesity rates. And so as your body gets larger, it becomes more difficult to get around, and you're more injury prone, and there's more wear and tear on your body. And when that happens, there's perhaps an inclination to take pain pills for that or self-medicate with alcohol. And as people get larger, they oftentimes experience depression and shame and anxiety about that, and it could lead itself to poor mental health outcomes as well. And so it's interesting to me that life expectancy is declining among very specific demographic groups and in very specific areas, and that it seems to be the case for multiple different diseases and causes of death and not just one particular disease. Because what that suggests to me is that there are larger structural problems that are occurring among that particular population and in those particular geographic areas that we have to attend to. Otherwise, I think we're going to keep seeing an upward trend in these mortality rates.
That was Shannon Monat, Assistant Professor of Rural Sociology, Demography, and Sociology at Penn State University.
Speaking of Trump voters, Matt Iglesias, a writer I don't often find myself agreeing with, made an interesting point recently on a post on Vox. It's wrong to speak of the Trump voter as some sort of singular or average figure, he argued. Instead, there are three kinds of Trump voters: hardcore bigots who love the xenophobic talk, partisan Republicans who want tax cuts and who would vote for whomever the party nominated, and a floating population of the discontented, who are taken in by Trump's critical talk about job loss, bad trade deals, and corruption. Of course, that sort of talk was pure snake oil. Trump's hard cabinet appointments make it clear that he plans to govern from a conventionally right perspective, though with a hideously vulgar and demagogic style. The rural working class who fell for this hucksterism are already being betrayed before he even takes office. The first two parts of the Trump coalition, the bigots and the partisans, will probably remain solidly behind him. But the third part, the floating discontented, some of whom probably voted for Obama only to be disappointed that he never delivered the promised hope and change, are almost certainly open to the appeal of a Sanders-style agenda. Many liberals reject the idea of trying to talk with Trump supporters, viewing them as an undifferentiated mass of haters, but I think that's wrong. The wrongest thing to do would be to get behind toxic crap like an entry posted to the Daily Coast by its founder, Marcos Melitzis, the other day, with the charming headline, "Be happy for coal miners losing their health insurance, they're getting exactly what they voted for." It actually contained these sentences: "Don't weep for these coal miners now abandoned by their GOP patrons. They are getting exactly the government that they voted for." The contempt shown by liberals for the rural working class is odious in itself and only greases the pathway for more Trumps in the future. You're listening to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Back after a musical break.
Soviet nerve gas attack. In 6 seconds they'll be pushing on your back. Get a drop on your skin and convulsion will set in. Soviet nerve gas attack. Soviet nerve gas is strange. In a missile with a 1,000-mile range, it spreads out a mile to contaminate a while. Soviet nerve gas is strange. Soviet nerve gas is strong. Snort it up, then you won't be snorting long. An insecticide for men, it's genocide again. Soviet nerve gas is strong.
That was some of Soviet Nerve Gas Attack by the early 1980s New Jersey band XEX. I was never clear on how to pronounce it. Maybe it's Zex. In any case, XEX is a spelling. And why not? It's Cold War paranoia all over again. Which is a good lead-in for a rare bit of extended commentary from me, a slight expansion of something I wrote for The Guardian earlier this week. For the last several weeks, the U.S. political and media establishment have been in a state of mounting frenzy over alleged Russian interference in the presidential election, interference in favor of Trump. How do we know this? The New York Times attributed it to a swell of circumstantial evidence, which sounds like rather a stretch. And the source of all this evidence is the CIA, an agency which has not been particularly well known for its honesty during its seven-decade history, and which has been known to interfere with an election or two itself. Practically its first act as a newborn was to interfere in the Italian election of 1948 to prevent communists from coming to power. In that noble pursuit, it worked with the Sicilian Mafia, which is famous for its deep concern for human rights. And what exactly are the claims made by these Putin did it stories? That were it not for Russian chicanery, Hillary Clinton would have won the popular vote by 5 million and not a mere 3 million? That displaced machinists on the banks of Lake Erie were so incensed by the Podesta emails that they voted for Trump instead of Clinton? That Putin was pulling FBI Director James Comey's strings in his investigation of the Clinton emails? That those scheming Russians were clever enough to hack into voting machines but not clever enough to cover their tracks? It's all strangely reminiscent of the days of the Red Scare, minus the Reds. Each of those questions opens up an interesting line of inquiry. Though it's not gone unremarked upon, the fact that the loser of the popular vote has won the election for the second time in 16 years is an entirely homegrown disgrace. It would be nice if we spent at least as much time talking about how this bizarre institution, originally designed to protect the power of slaveholders, perverts democracy. But the Electoral College is widely considered an immutable feature of our political system. And that's not even to mention the rampant voter suppression, the difficulties of getting on the ballot, the scheduling of elections on weekdays rather than weekends, as the rest of the world does it, thereby making it harder for the working class to vote, this legacy of two centuries of trying to make the franchise as much of a luxury good as the elites can get away with. Julian Assange denies that the Russian government was the source of the hacked emails to and from Clinton campaign chair John Podesta that WikiLeaks published. Of course, there's no way of knowing whether he's telling the truth, but regardless of their source, how much influence do those emails have on the election outcome? We can never know, but it sure seems that only a handful of connoisseurs read through them. And those who did discovered precisely how cynical and empty the Clinton operation was, like the moment when campaign manager Robbie Mook asked Podesta and several other senior operatives, quote, where we landed exactly on trade. Is she going to say she supports it? It presumably being the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Hillary supported as Secretary of State but came to oppose for electoral reasons. Those displaced machinists in the industrial Midwest, whose votes helped put Trump in the White House, believe that free trade deals are responsible for their economic woes, and they never trusted Clinton's turn against the TPP. But that was Hillary's campaign for you, bereft of principle and pathologically concerned with optics at the expense of substance. They were so confident in their inevitable victory that they wrote off the old industrial states in favor of luring upscale suburbanites who normally vote Republican. They hoped they would be so revolted by Trump that they would vote for her, but they didn't. It's easy to blame the FBI for the trouble that the private email server scandal caused the Clinton campaign, but the decision to set that thing up was hers and no one else's. It was entirely consistent with her long history of secrecy, of trying to evade public scrutiny for her actions, one of the reasons that so many people really never trusted her. And the voting machines. The American balloting system is a chaotic mess, with an array of state and local authorities conducting elections under a vast variety of rules, using technology ranging from old-fashioned paper ballots to sleek touchscreen devices. The former take forever to count, and the latter are unauditable. We could never have any idea of whether these counts are accurate. An attempt to recount the votes in Detroit revealed a hopeless mess. The whole system is a perfect example of a quote attributed, probably falsely, to Joseph Stalin. The people who cast the votes decide nothing. The people who count the votes decide everything. It's not a system designed to inspire trust, but we barely discuss that. It's much easier to discuss Devil Putin. It's probably a near-universal feature of human psychology that it's easier to blame others for our problems than to look inward for their origins. Democrats would rather point to shady foreign operators than think about why Hillary Clinton will not be the one taking the oath on January 20th. The establishment Republicans who've joined the bandwagon demanding inquiries into Russian interference apparently prefer that to figuring out how their party nominated a volatile lunatic who will become president in a little more than a month. And Americans across the political spectrum are happy to use Putin to distract them from reflecting on how baseless our self-image as the world's greatest democracy is. But as with many psychological defenses, these sorts of evasions are very damaging to long-term health. And that's the end of the mildly expanded version of a piece I wrote for The Guardian earlier this week. Instead of a musical break, how about a poetry break?
America, when I was 7, Mama took me to communist cell meetings. They sold us garbanzos, a handful per ticket. A ticket cost a nickel and the speeches were free. Everybody was angelic and sentimental about the workers. It was all so sincere, you have no idea what a good thing the party was in 1835. Scott Nearing was a grand old man, a real mensch. Mother Bloor made me cry. I once saw Israel Amter plane. Everybody must have been a spy. America, you don't really want to go to war. America, it's them bad Russians. Them Russians, and them Chinamen, and them Russians. The Russia wants to eat us alive. The Russia's power mad. She wants to take our cars from out our garages. Her wants to grab Chicago. Her needs Red Readers' digests. Her wants our auto plants in Siberia. Him big bureaucracy running our filling stations. That no good.
There's a bit of Allen Ginsberg reading his poem, America. And now Mark Ames. Back in 1997, Mark was the co-founder, along with Matt Taibbi, of the Moscow-based English-language biweekly The Exile, which is a mix of very rude satire and tough investigative reporting. The Russian 1990s were a wild time, with the country in chaos and Boris Yeltsin presiding over a vast looting of former state assets of the failed USSR. A regular feature of the exile was vicious profiles of Western journalists in Moscow, who knew nothing about the country, speaking Russian was a rarity among them, and simply reported whatever their editors and the U.S. government wanted to hear. 11 years after its founding, the Putin government, in the person of the Ministry to Defend Russian Culture, shut the paper down. Mark Ames is the author of Going Postal, A Marvelous Analysis of Workplace Murder, and is now a co-host of Radio War Nerd, along with another exile veteran, Gary Brescher. You can find that on Patreon.com or by Googling Radio War Nerd. Mark Ames. Russia, very much in the news these days. What do you make of the Putin did it hysteria?
It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I think for a while, I think the Russians were really enjoying it. In fact, I just saw Sergei Dorienko. He's this guy who, he was the mouthpiece for the Putin clan in 1999-2000 when the Putin clan versus, I don't know, the Primakov clan trying to take power. And this guy was Putin's man. Then he fell out with Putin, then went in with Putin, out with Putin. He's a fairly famous guy anyway. He tweeted out yesterday, the day before, wow, we're the coolest people in the world, you know, and linked to some article about how Russia's manipulating America's elections. He meant it ironically. I think for the Russians, it's also largely, I think it's getting to the point where it's starting to weird them out. I think they were enjoying it for a while, not, you know, being at the center of everyone's attention and everyone's worries. I think it's getting to the point where it's starting to weird them out. I don't know what to say. It's bizarre. Our establishment, and this has happened before, I've talked about this on our Radio Warner podcast, in the late 70s, 1980, you know, the Reagan people came to power basically saying everything that happened in the 70s was a Soviet disinformation plot. And everybody, you know, Seymour Hersh and the Church Committee and all these people were dupes of a Soviet disinformation campaign to destabilize us so that they could and paralyze us so that they could take over the world. And it just, it was a bad time for the establishment then, and it's a bad time for the establishment now. And you always, it's a lot easier to blame nefarious alien outsiders, than to look within yourself. They're in a panic. So, you know, you blame the aliens, you can get away with blaming. I think they have a harder time blaming, let's say, China, because it looks so obviously racist. If you just changed everything that's written about Russia, if you put in China or Mexico, it looks so obviously xenophobic and racist. And, you know, Russians are the sort of Hollywood villains, and it's acceptable because they're white, and you don't have to think about how 20 million were killed by Hitler and they were only emancipated in 1861 and these other things. They just say, oh, they're white people, you know.
The psychopolitics of it remind me of the Red Scare, except without Reds. I mean, it's like we're running a tape. A fight that's not about something, the way the Cold War was in some sense about something, but I don't get what this is quite all about.
I don't either, I know. I mean, the thing that annoys me about trying to compare it to McCarthyism, that was about destroying the left and labor. And here it's about, you know, on the surface, it's about trying to destroy a reactionary. So a bunch of liberals are okay with it this time. But really, it's about a panic over losing control over, you know, the narrative and over control over power. And it's just a giant freak out. And I think what it does show is how deeply embedded Cold War culture, Cold War structures, Cold War thinking are into our system. And we've never reckoned with it or changed it. We've modified it. You know, there were some base closings in the 90s, but if you actually think about it, the Cold War was never the Cold War structurally and culturally and everything else never dismantled. So it's so easy for us to fall back on this same enemy and the same paranoia, even if there isn't the same alleged existential threat or ideological threat, which is real, that was there in the Cold War.
The senior players in this, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, John McCain, people like this, are old enough to remember the Cold War. You know, about half of our population probably was born after the Cold War ended. I mean, it's a weird historical afterlife for something that must strike a lot of people as incomprehensible.
Yeah, but then I also noticed like a lot of hacker types, and hacker types really like to think that, I mean, there are some of them who are sort of just generally, you know, anti-system, let's say, but a lot of them love to think that they have special inside knowledge. You know, the country needs them to rescue them from some alien super high-tech enemy. And a lot of these guys are into this too, because Russia and Russian hackers are good. That's, you know, been true. And it's like a hacker war story. So I think people even born after the Cold War, but who grew up on Hollywood movies, where, as I said, culturally, we just kind of kept the Russians as the enemies. In fact, I think it was either Stoller or Barry Lynn or something was talking about how, there were some films being made where the Chinese were the villains, Chinese mafia or something. And when the Chinese government or investors or something in this Hollywood studio chain or, you know, objected to it, they just switched it and put Russians in. And Russia's a mystery. It'll always be a mystery for us. And there's been so much written about Putin. Putin is just such a fascinating villain. He's such a perfect stereotype villain, that you can kind of plug in any input into him that you want. The older people, I can tell you this, I know, have spoken to people, even, let's say, close to the Clinton camp circle, going back a while, and their paranoia about Russia behind every bad thing that's happened to Hillary, that the FSB and stuff, is very real. This is not, I mean, I almost kind of wish it was like a cynical public relations, you know, group of people who thought, what can we do? And they polled it, and if they came up with this. Actually, this polls really badly. Nobody really does care that much, except a few people, about this alleged Russian threat. But they genuinely believe it. From everything I've heard, from my own personal experiences, having talked to some of these people over the last couple of years, they think, you know, Guccifer was an FSB plant. I mean, I've heard the wildest, craziest stories from people who are, some people very close to the Hillary Clinton people.
Well, I hate to quote Donald Trump approvingly, but, you know, his remarks about the 400-pound hacker probably had some truth in it.
We don't know. I mean, that's the thing. We don't know. And you know, nobody's applying kind of professional skepticism to this. Most people sort of, they so badly don't want the establishment to have been utterly rejected like this. And they don't want Donald Trump, for obvious reasons, to come to power. So they just, they want to believe that anything, they want to hold on to any bit of evidence that proves that actually it's not really Hillary's fault, it's the Russians' fault, it's the outside agitator's fault. That said, I'm still completely open to believing that it's, the Russians had some role in this somewhere. I do believe there's some connection between WikiLeaks and the Russians. I don't believe that he's controlled by the Russians. They have some mutual interest, let's say, you know.
No, but let's review this evidence. I mean, the Times the other day came up with a phrase which really stunned me in its bizarreness, a swell of circumstantial evidence.
I know.
This, I mean, this, wow, I mean, you know, that almost, you know, language, it's like Jacques Derrida is manning the news desk now.
Yes, it is. This is why I'm so skeptical. Like, I'm willing to believe it. The Russians have the motive, because we've done this to them again over and over. They have the means. They're very good hackers. And yet every time we're presented evidence, it looks like the WMD Iraq war lead up. We're being conned.
Well, it's the CIA saying, trust us. And you know, they're the last people in the world you want to trust, right?
Yes. This is what is so bothersome. And, you know, watching people get away with such little evidence. Yeah. Really does come down to, do you trust the CIA? And then all of a sudden, all these liberals, you saw this too. This is just shows how wacky everything is. Pelosi, but a whole bunch of liberals who I've liked for a while, coming out and saying, actually, the CIA didn't get the WMDs wrong. They got it right. Like, they're just rewriting history so that we can then believe them on this. Like, this is how desperate and crazy people are. That it's weirdly, on the one hand, both kind of really funny and weirdly entertaining to watch this total meltdown. But on the other hand, you just know this is going to end really badly.
Yeah, well, it doesn't look good. And it's also looking like a way they're trying to overturn the election results, which,
yes.
You know, it's just it seems very unwise, let's put it that way. Let's talk a bit about why Putin and the Russian government might not trust the U.S. I mean, the activities in Ukraine, for example, have not been totally above board, have they?
Well, no. Not only do we back the groups that started and stage managed the Maidan Revolution, which had genuine grievances behind it, you know, but would not have happened without our backing, put it that way. Genuine grievances, very real grievances, but wouldn't have happened without our backing. We stage managed the transition. We decided who was going to be the mayor. Klitschko goes here. Poroshenko goes here. Yatsenyuk goes here. And they watched that whole thing. Yeah. But I mean, let's go back even further. Putin being both an FSB, KGB guy, having been close with Yeltsin, he also knows how much that, you know, the role that we have played in Russian politics in the post-Soviet era. We helped on many levels, not just these advisors that the film was made about, but in funding and loans and all kinds of levels, we helped Yeltsin steal, and it was stolen, the 1996 election.
You know, I once asked a New York Times reporter who spent some time in Russia why the paper didn't cover that the electoral theft of 96, and I was told there was no story there.
Yeah, well, I guess, which is to say there's no story that people, I don't know, that our readers want to read or that our editors want our readers to read. I mean,
well, the State Department would approve of.
Yeah, it's but they were all on the same page. The idea was we have to keep the communists out. You know, it's the same thing. We're willing to do these really terrible anti-democratic things to prevent what we in our panic think is the end of the world. Damn the consequences for the future. And the template for every stolen election afterwards, you could say in part the 93 election, we backed it when Yeltsin shut down parliament and then bombed it, you know, with his helicopters and tanks, and then replaced it in a rigged election that we fully backed again in 1993.
Yeah, I used to be on this email list of a bunch of elite liberal pundits, and none of them knew about or could remember Yeltsin shelling the parliament in 93.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Selective amnesia is also really useful here. But 1996, you know, that's when Yeltsin was brought from St. Petersburg to Moscow to work in the Kremlin. So he saw that exact template and all the Americans that were involved in that. And again, the template was very similar. It was, you know, in Chechnya, for example, in 1996. This is after Yeltsin had butchered, so, you know, you don't know the exact numbers, but 75,000 to 100,000 Chechens. Something like 98% of the Chechens voted for Yeltsin. And the voter turnout was about 120% or something, you know. So, and that was just one area. And it's a very similar thing they do up through today. The only difference is today we make hay out of it. We help amplify grievances about vote fraud and, you know, decry it rather than covering it up as we did in 96.
I'm speaking with the journalist Mark Ames. It's really, really rich to see the CIA going on about interfering in foreign elections. I mean, like, the first act of their birth was interfering in the 48 Italian elections. That's really,
yep.
It's in their blood. Getting back to the Ukraine question, just how many fascists are there in that government?
You know, so when I wrote this last article, some people tried to mischaracterize it as me saying it's I'm following Russian talking points that it's a fascist junta. It's not a fascist junta. It's a combination of oligarchs, fascists, neo-fascists, and sort of neoliberal ideologues, although there are much fewer than neoliberals now than in the days and months after the 2014 revolution. But I'd say at the highest parts of power, you have the Speaker of the Parliament, Andrei Parubi, is the founder of the Social National Party of Ukraine. The leading neo-Nazi in Ukraine is the Speaker of Parliament. The head of the Minister of Interior, a real scumbag. My God, Arsen Avakov, I think his name is. He's the sponsor of like all these neo-Nazi battalions, like the Azov Battalion. He'll deploy them, try to undermine them a bit, redeploy them at his will. Mostly for guys like that and for some of the oligarchs who back these neo-Nazi brigades, a lot of that really began in terms of taking over businesses and controlling businesses. They use, it's kind of where the original fascists came from, right? They were criminals, thugs and war and veterans and mercenaries who were used by big business to, well, back then it was more to bust up unions. There's no real union power in Ukraine. What there is you use them to do what they call raiderstva. You literally physically raid and physically take over other people's companies and dare them to take it back or you kill them. So the Minister of the Interior is deep in with these guys. And now the new head of the National Police, who was the mayor of Kyiv, he's also a very well-known neo-Nazi. And then you have them sprinkled throughout. I mean, you have the guy who's sort of in charge of rewriting Ukraine's history in a government function, is very in with the lovers of Bandera. He's a what do you call it, a neo-fascist, I guess, these OUN Bandera lovers. So they're high up there in the highest rungs of power, and Poroshenko, the oligarch president, the chocolate king, Willy Wonka, he didn't play too much of a nationalist card before, but since he knows where power is, is playing up to the ultra nationalists. He's made heroes out of World War II Nazi collaborators. He's made it a crime to criticize people who were groups that were involved in the Holocaust and who massacred Poles. And, you know, it's funny that while you're not hearing a whole lot from, there's some Jewish organizations that are livid about this, but they're very split over this because they don't want to upset America and the West. The Poles, who are now have a very ultra-nationalist government themselves, is very quickly heating up a lot of anger between Poland and Hungary. And in fact, Poland passed a law saying that what the Ukrainian nationalists did in World War II was a genocide of Poles. And now, just I think a day or two ago, in a border town that's inside of Poland but used to be a more of a Ukrainian town, you know, those borders have been moved around, the mayor of this town, they held a march. The marchers yelled "Death to Ukraine," and the mayor led the march. And today in the Senate, or in the parliament, in the Polish parliament, the same, they're now tabling a new amendment. There's a law that that basically makes communism and Nazism both equally evil and illegal. And now they're going to equate Ukrainian nationalism with that.
The U.S. interest in supporting this kind of thing is none other than causing trouble for Russia, right?
Yeah, this is all about these guys are willing to do the kind of ugly stuff that nice neoliberal middle-class people won't do, which is fighting, killing, making trouble, pinning down Russia. And so they've been useful. They've been useful for us since the start of the Cold War. We used to parachute these crazy Ukrainian Nazi collaborators in by the hundreds into the Soviet Union to cause trouble. Unfortunately for them, nearly all of them were immediately captured, shot, and killed, one after another. But they're willing to die and willing to kill, so they're useful for us. I don't think we have much vision right now. You know, there's sort of Obama definitely had no vision, so then people like Nuland move into the Vicky Nuland, the neocon, moves into the void and starts screwing everything up. I don't think there's like a overarching vision here. I think the idea is tell the Poles to shut up, keep the Ukraine border hot so that we can keep Russia pinned down.
And Nuland, of course, wife of Robert Kagan and installed by Hillary Clinton and likely to have played a role in a Hillary Clinton administration. Now, we should say, though, that you were driven out of Russia by the Putin government. You are no friend of Putin, right?
No. In fact, my newspaper, as far as I know, or as far as I was told by human rights lawyers when this was happening to me in Moscow, Russian human rights lawyers, it's the only newspaper that received the kind of notice that I received in Moscow, certainly the only English language paper. We were shut down. We were notified through what was called an urgent unplanned audit of our editorial content. They sent four Kremlin agents to our office. I was accused of extremism and a few other things. Satire is not an excuse there, and our paper was very over-the-top offensive in its satire. But also we wrote a lot of very serious political commentary and investigative journalism, and we had, you know, some leading figures in the opposition writing for us. They shut us down. And then the head of Nashi, which is the Kremlin youth group, was screaming on radio, calling me an extremist and an enemy. And so I got a phone call after that, was told to go immediately, grab a bag, put a few days worth of clothes in it, go straight to the airport, buy the first one-way ticket to, you know, a Western country where you know somebody, and get out now. That's what I did. That was in 2008.
And so what do you think of the Putin government now, 8 years later?
I don't like them. There's not much to like about them. I just cannot understand. And this goes back to the late summer 2008 with McCain. I can't understand this drive to a new Cold War. I mean, it's annoying to me that I find myself in the position of de facto defending them, according to the stupid, you know, rhetoric of our age, simply because I'm not I'm skeptical and critical of this push for a new Cold War and demonizing Russia and, you know, puffing them up as this frightening enemy. This country is largely a basket case. You know, if people went there and saw this country, they're being built up as like this super high tech futuristic demon, Klingon, you know, Klingon Death Star country. It's like it's largely a basket case with a few pockets of success. It's not a threat. It's a joke.
I was just reading an interview with George Friedman, a fellow who thinks himself, oh, yeah, you know, the proprietor of a private CIA at Stratfor. Yeah. But he says that the U.S. government's big fear is some kind of alliance between Germany and Russia, and they want to do anything to prevent that from happening. What do you think is driving this antipathy to Russia?
I honestly, as I told you before, I think the Cold War structure mentality. I think that the our national security establishment and syndicate don't like a dirty, nasty, low cost counterinsurgency wars of the global war on terror, as they call it. They don't like it. They want big ticket weapons with a big, sexy white enemy, and they love the Cold War days. And in fact, I heard from a friend, a reporter who's talking about, so there was a reporter from London who just died, who covered a lot of Russia stuff. And when Litvinenko was poisoned, you know, the former Russian spy who became a dissident in London, and he was poisoned with plutonium. I do believe that. I do believe the FSB or even Putin would be involved in that. Personally, I believe that. But in any event, what this guy said at the time was, covering that story, he said, "You have no idea how happy all the spies are here because they hate fighting dark-skinned people in a dirty counterinsurgency war, that they all look at this as going back to the good old days." And I think that's it. And you know, our journalists are largely tools. They're suckers for, hey, psst, I'm in the CIA or I'm close to the CIA, and I can tell you something just between us, but you can't quote my name. Here's some real inside information. You have these doofuses, these tools who have no world experience whatsoever, who are willing to repackage whatever spies tell them to heat this Cold War up again. So I think culturally, structurally, it's all there. And there's just a lot of budgetary reasons, self-interest reasons for getting a Cold War going as well. I think the idea that we're scared of Germany and Russia aligning, that's such classic Stratfor BS. These guys, I don't know. It's like they're constantly playing Risk and dreaming of World War II or something. And they appeal to people who have the same Risk fetish. You remember that board game Risk? I don't know. It's just really idiotic that the idea that Germany would ever ally with Russia against us is, yeah, that's sad.
Finally, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but how are you feeling about the imminence of Donald Trump?
You know, the thing is, I would have time to really dread deeply in my bones if the liberals weren't distracting me so much with their insane meltdown over Russia and what looks really like they're preparing. I mean, when you have all these establishment credible figures calling into question and, you know, calling it a coup, calling it a Russian coup, you are setting the stage. And I don't know what they have planned, setting the stage to remove him from power. And I don't like Trump. I can't stand Trump. I mean, I dread Trump coming to power. It's going to be the worst of Warren Harding and the worst of Reagan, it looks like. It's going to be awful. So, but I haven't really had time to dread it because of all the other stuff. I mean, the one thing I know is the Russia story. I know that pretty well, and it happens to be the big story. And so I'm very distracted by that for now.
That was Mark Ames, co-founder of The Exile, author of Going Postal, and co-host of the Radio War Nerd podcast. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of Afraid of the Russians by Made for TV, produced by the great John Cale. Till next week, bye.
I'd like to feed the children. Find a cure for disease. Rebuild cities and plant a lot of trees. I'd like to help the sick, build factories, give money to students, hospitals and galleries, but I'm afraid of the Russians.
can't sleep at night. So afraid of the Russians. Afraid we've got to fight. I'd like to go to space. Clean up rivers and lakes. Put everyone to work.